Shall we begin?
Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Sahavidyam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavati Tamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
We'll begin with some recitation in chapter 2. Repeat after me.
Nainam chindanti shastrani, nainam chindanti shastrani, nainam dahati pavakaha, nainam dahati pavakaha, na chainam kledayantyapo, na shoshayati marutaha, Achedyo yamadahyoyam,
Achedyo yamadahyoyam,
Akledyo shoshahevacha,
Akledyo shoshahevacha,
Nitya sarvagataskhanur,
Nitya sarvagataskhanur,
Achaloyam sanatanah,
Achaloyam sanatanah,
Avyakto yam achintyoyam, Avikaryo yamuchyate,
Avikaryo yamuchyate,
Tasmadevam viditvainam,
Tasmadevam viditvainam,
Nanushochitam arhasi,
Nanushochitam arhasi,
Atha chainam nitya jatam,
Atha chainam nitya jatam,
Nityam vamanyase mritam, Tathapi Tvam Mahabaho,
Tathapi Tvam Mahabaho,
Nainam Shochitam Arhasi,
Nainam Shochitam Arhasi,
Jatasya Hi Dhruvo Mrityur,
Jatasya Hi Dhruvo Mrityur,
Dhruvam Janma Mrtasya Cha,
Dhruvam Janma Mrtasya Cha,
Tasmada Pariharyerte, Natvam shochitam arhasi,
Natvam shochitam arhasi,
Avyaktadini bhutani,
Avyaktadini bhutani,
Vyaktamadhyani bharata,
Vyaktamadhyani bharata,
Avyaktanidhananyeva,
Avyaktanidhananyeva,
Tatraka paridevana, Ashcharyavat pashyati kashcharenam,
Ashcharyavat pashyati kashcharenam,
Ashcharyavat varati tathaiva chanyah, Ashcharyavat varati tathaiva chanyah, Ashcharyavat chainam anyashrinoti, Ashcharyavat chainam anyashrinoti, Shrutvapyenam veda na chaiva kashchita, Shrutvapyenam veda na chaiva kashchita, Dehi nityam avadhyoyam,
Dehi nityam avadhyoyam,
Dehe sarvasya bharata,
Dehe sarvasya bharata,
Tasmat sarvani bhutani, Natvam shochitam arhasi,
Natvam shochitam arhasi,
Swadharmam api chaveksya,
Swadharmam api chaveksya,
Navikampitam arhasi,
Navikampitam arhasi,
Dharmyadhi yuddhat shreyonyata, Dharmyadhi yuddhat shreyon, Kshatriyasya navidyate, Yachreha chopam, I'm sorry. Yadritchaya chopapannam. Now we have a typo up there, that's what it is. No, I'm looking at the typo, excuse me. Because I have to remember to fix that later. Yadrachaya Chopapannam. Swargadwaramapavritam. Sukhina Kshatriya Partha. Labhante Yuddham Idrisham.
Very good. This is the first time we're using all of these slides, so we're finding little typos as we go along, not surprisingly. All right. We pick up. In our last class, we began to understand the doctrine of karma. If you missed the last class, you might like to consider getting the tape because it will really help you. And we're going to continue in today's class talking about the doctrine of karma, which is a fairly involved teaching, and it bears proper understanding. And we commented last week about how destructive the misinterpretations of this doctrine of karma become. At the end of our last class, we looked at the common belief that whatever is going to happen to you in your life is predetermined or predestined in some way by your karma, and what a world-negating, passive, undesirable belief. And the ancient rishis never taught that. And what a shame it is in modern times when people misinterpret the doctrine of karma, turn it into some kind of passive excuse not to do anything. Doesn't it often come out like that? Somebody's in a miserable situation, and they say, you know, the usual expression, yeah, kya karunga. Mera karma aisa hi hai. You know, this is what it is. And then what do they do? Kuch nahi. Nothing. And what is the excuse they give for doing nothing is they say, because of karma, I can't do anything. I'll drop the Hindi and go to nice American slang. This is called a cop-out. Cop-out. Cop-out means we give ourselves a lame excuse. We give ourselves an excuse not to do anything. This is it's a crime against Hindu religion to make this misinterpretation. At the end of the last class, we established the fact that while it is a fact that karma affects you, karma is not the only thing affecting you. You also have free will. In every situation, you also have free will. Karma is a fact. We don't deny that. Free will is also a fact. Don't deny it. And when somebody says, whatever is going to happen is predetermined by my karma, they are denying the fact of their own free will. And we looked at that fairly extensively in the last class, just to revisit it briefly. One thing we can say to understand how free will and karma are both present in every situation, a nice simplification is this, to say that the situation is born of your karma, the response to that situation depends on your free will. What a simple way of looking at it. And I admit it's a somewhat of an oversimplification. It's true. It's an oversimplification, but it's still extremely helpful. The situation you confront is born of karma. How you respond to that situation is free will. We gave that nice traditional river example in the last class. I won't go through that again. Can I give you an updated version? Do you think the ancient rishis ever played billiards pool? No. But if they did, they might have used a billiard ball as an example to explain karma. Suppose you hit this billiard ball in this direction. It's your cue. You bang it right there. And, of course, banging it right there, you certainly expect it to go in that direction. What would you say if you banged the billiard ball here and it went off in this direction? Huh? First of all, it's possible. There are several things that could cause the billiard ball to go off in an unexpected direction. Suppose the pool table is tilted. That could cause it. Suppose there's a strong wind blowing. Possible. Don't laugh. We'll stay with the tilted pool table. You won't laugh so much. All right. Now, there could be other factors acting upon the ball that you're not aware of. An unknown factor acting on that ball, or what scientists would call a hidden variable. In this case, we can imagine that if the table were tilted down, there would be a force of gravity acting on the pool, on the billiard ball in that direction, and the final direction a ball would take would be the result of both forces, both the force you exerted on the ball and the unknown force caused by the tilting of the table or blowing wind or whatever other factor you want to imagine. And in this example, your striking of the billiard ball with the pool stick represents free will. When we make actions in life, when we use our free will in life, look what happens. We have a goal in mind. We see the direction we need to go to make it to our goal. But when we make that effort, what do we find happening in our life? Things turn out sometimes very differently than what we expect. Why? What scientists call hidden variable, that's according to scientists. How about according to laymen? Lay people don't use complicated expressions like hidden variable. Lay people use this expression. Luck. Why didn't it go the direction it wanted to? I don't know. I don't have good luck. And we discussed in our last class that good luck, bad luck are euphemisms for I don't know. Hidden variable. The ancient rishis studied. They observed. They observed generation after generation after generation, and they formulated this doctrine of karma, and that's what that vector, that force, represents the force of karma. Notice then that the direction the ball goes is not purely the result of karma, not purely the result of free will, but the result of both. And this accurately describes what the ancient rishis taught, and that is what unfolds in our life is a product of both karma and free will, which means you can never say you're helpless. Suppose, having hit this pool ball several times, if you're smart enough, couldn't you figure out that the table is tilted? Couldn't you figure out that the wind is blowing or something? After a while, you can figure it out. And when you figure it out, can you compensate for it? Sure. If you notice that it's always going more this way than you expect, you might compensate by striking it down here a little bit. Eventually, if the goal in billiards is to get the ball into the hole. If the table is tilted, is it impossible to get the ball into the hole? No. It's harder because you have to figure out the effect of the table being tilted. It's harder, but it's still possible. In the same way, the fact that we have karma in our lives makes life more complicated,
But what can we do? Life is complicated. We don't have any choice. But just as you can slowly figure out what's going on the pool table, in the same way we can figure out what's going on in life. Now, what we've just discussed pretty much summarizes the last class. We want to finish our discussion on the doctrine of karma right now by relating it to the process of reincarnation. And that's really the context. In the series of verses, Sri Krishna is telling Arjuna, hey Arjuna, you don't have to worry so much about your family members who are dying, because everyone who's born dies, and everyone who dies gets reborn. So that's the context in the Bhagavad Gita, and it's because of that teaching that we're talking about this doctrine of karma, because there's no way to explain rebirth, punarjanma, without understanding the doctrine of karma. The two teachings are absolutely interrelated. Karma and rebirth, you cannot separate these two topics. So let's see now, how do these two things tie together? We said that each and every one of us are born in this life. We're born with good and bad karmas from prior lives. And this is such a fundamental teaching of karma, and such an important teaching. Look at this. And I think I'm not sure if we talked about this in the last class or not, but even if we did, it's worth restating. How many religions struggle with the question, why do bad things happen to good people? This is a major, major issue. Why do bad things happen to good people? Religious people and struggle with this question again and again and again. And here in this doctrine of karma, we have a simple and clear explanation, and that is, even the most saintly person among us are born with some papa karma, bad karmas from a prior life. You may not have committed any bad actions in this life, but certainly past lives, probably, we've all made mistakes. You think so? Do we all make mistakes? Is there any one of us here? No, I never made a mistake. We all make mistakes. In this life and in past lives, based on these mistakes that we've made, we all come into this life with a combination of punya and papa karmas, a combination of good and bad karmas, and here's the bottom line. The punya karmas you're born with, the good karmas that we're born with, guarantee that we will have good things happen to us in this life that we don't deserve. Did anything good ever happen to you that you didn't deserve, that you didn't work for? A lot, correct? How many wonderful things have happened to us, have come into our lives that we didn't deserve, we didn't work for? You come from a loving and wonderful family. What did you do to deserve being born in a good family? No, nothing in this life. How to explain it? Purva janma, from karma, from a prior life. So the good karmas we're born with guarantee that we will all experience many, many good things that we don't deserve based on our actions in this life. Similarly, the other side of the coin, our papa karmas we're all born with guarantee that we will all undergo suffering in this life that we don't deserve. And what a perfect explanation for why do bad things happen to good people. If you're a good person and you're suffering, it's not because God is punishing you. If you're a good person and you're suffering, it's because, like any other human being, you are born with papa karmas and therefore subject to suffering. This is a human condition. We are all subject to both punya and papa karmas. And to summarize that, how many times someone who's suffering something terrible say, why is this happening to me? Why me? Why me? I'm a good person. I've lived a good life. I don't hurt people. Why is this happening to me? Why me? In this tradition, we can turn it around and say, why not me? After all, every other human being is subject to undeserved suffering. Except me. Does that work? Every other human being is subject to undeserved suffering. Am I so special or different that I should have a special exemption to that rule? Everyone is subject to undeserved suffering except me, because I'm special, I'm different. We cannot say that. So we turn it around. Instead of saying, why me? We say, why not me? All right. Now, you're born with punya and papa karmas from prior lives. How much? How many karmas? A lot? A little? Do you think we can explore this? We'll try. So how much karma we're born with, I suppose, would depend on how many prior lives you've had. Is there a way to calculate how many prior lives you've had? Surprisingly, there is. It's a very simple mathematics. Here's how it works. To calculate how many lives we've lived, first thing we have to figure out is how many prior universes have there been. Because we can presume that when the universe exists, we get born again and again, but this universe was preceded by another universe. That universe was preceded by another one, and preceded by another one, and another, because according to the ancient rishis, we understand we live in a cyclic universe, a universe that goes through cycles of manifestation and dissolution, cycles of srishti and pralaya. Srishti, creation, pralaya is a state of being unmanifest. So, how many prior universes have there been? If you really understand the idea of cyclic, when does a perfect cycle begin? Cycle means circle. Where does a circle begin? By the way, I did this with a group of teenagers, and teens being the wise guys that they are, I asked, where does a circle begin? One teen observes, right here. Can't argue. That's where my circle began. But a perfect geometric circle, as you remember from a geometry class many decades ago, has no beginning and no end. If we understand that we live in a truly cyclic universe, we have to admit then that every universe has been preceded by another universe, in which case there was no first universe. And how many number of prior universes were there then? Infinite. This is what we understand. The moment you say that the universe is cyclic, along with that comes the understanding that there have been an infinite number of prior universes. Now, the next question is, in an infinite number of prior universes, how many times have you been born? You didn't know you're coming to a mathematics class, geometry, and now this infinity stuff. Let's look. It's not that complicated. The universe lasts for a long time. You know, according to modern science, this universe started to exist about 12 billion years ago, and it's going to exist for some more time. Billions and billions of years, however long it is. In billions of years, how many times do you think you get reborn? You have no idea. It would be reasonable to assume that every time the universe exists, that you're born many, many times. It would be a reasonable assumption, but we don't know. Suppose in billions of years, you're only born several times. Possible. Suppose you're only born once. Possible. Suppose you're not even born once. Suppose 10 universes come and go, and you're only born once. Possible? Suppose 100 million. Suppose 1 million universes come and go, and you're only born once. Possible? Possible. Then, can we calculate how many lives you've had? We can. Because if there have been an infinite number of prior lives, and you get born every millionth universe, so 1 in 1 million times, how's your math? In a million universes, you're born once, but since there have been an infinite number of prior universes, how many times have you been born? All right. So this is an examination of what we'll call Hindu cosmology, the way the ancient rishis envisioned the universe. Infinite number of prior universes, infinite number of prior lives, and now finally we can come back to karma. In an infinite number of prior lives, how many good karmas do you think you've accumulated? And how many bad karmas do you think you've accumulated? So here we got one of those good news, bad news stories. The good news is you've accumulated an infinite amount of good karma. The bad news is you've accumulated an infinite amount of bad karma. And how can it be otherwise? This is just simple. It's all based on this concept of the cyclic universe. So let this circle represent your total accumulated karma. The term we use for total accumulated karma is sanchitta. Sanchitta literally means accumulated. So you have an accumulation of an infinite amount of good karma from an infinite number of prior lives. You have an infinite amount of bad karma from an infinite number of prior lives. This constitutes your sanchitta karma, your accumulated karma. Now, we have to explain this life. If you were born into this life with an infinite amount of punya and papa karma, how long would you have to live to exhaust all of that karma? You'd have to live infinite number of years. Remember, birth is driven by karma. We discussed that when we talked about sukshma sharira. Why does a subtle body get held together at the time of death? Why is a subtle body driven on to assume another physical body? And the answer is because of these karmas. So, if this life were created as a result of an infinite amount of punya and papa karmas, you'd have to live an infinite length of time. That doesn't make sense. So we can only assume that this life is not the result of an infinite amount of karma. It's the result of a finite amount of karma. Sanchitta is infinite. This life is finite. We're born with enough karma to keep us going for so many years. We have no idea how many years. The ancient yogis used to think that your life was determined by karma in terms of how many breaths you would breathe. In your life, so many millions or billions of breaths, and that was what was a reflection of the amount of karma. There's a small joke that goes along with that. Now you know why yogis practice pranayama. So if the length of your life is determined by how many times you breathe, if you slow down your breathing, you can live longer. All right. We understand that this life must be the result of not an infinite amount of accumulated karma, sanchitta, but a finite amount of karma. And what the rishis taught in his doctrine of karma is that this life is the result of a subset, a portion of the sanchitta karma gives rise to this life. This portion of karma, which is also composed of punya and papa. However, notice this is an infinite amount of punya and papa. This is a finite amount of punya and papa, enough to keep us going for 70, 80, 90 years. And this portion of karma is called prarabdha. Prarabdha literally means that which has begun. Pra-arabha. So that which has begun, that which has begun to unfold in this life. So according to the doctrine of karma, this life is not the result of an infinite amount of accumulated karma. This life is a result of a finite amount of punya and papa karmas, enough to keep us going until this life is over. Then, when these punya and papa karmas are exhausted, then we get reborn. And when we get reborn, guess what? Another batch of punya and papa karmas come from the sanchitta. And then you exhaust these karmas, and then you get reborn. What happens again? That's right. Again and again, another batch. Now, some things to bear in mind. When will you use up all of the sanchitta karma? Here we are siphoning off finite amounts. Every time we're born, we siphon off, as it were, a finite amount of karma. So when will we finally exhaust all that sanchitta karma? This is a math class now. So if you start subtracting finite amounts from infinity, when will it be zero? Never. So an infinite amount of sanchitta karma, when you go on subtracting finite amounts of prarabdha, it remains. So this is our cycle of life after life, or death after death after death. And there's as long as we've got this on the board, let's take a few minutes and fill in some of the further details. One detail we should explain here is the Hindu concept of heaven and hell, and how different the Hindu concept of heaven and hell is compared to the biblical view. Biblical view has it that you have one life and one life only. At the end of this life, you're judged for your actions, and you are sent to eternal heaven or eternal hell as a result of your actions in this one life. Now, this doctrine has some, I think, some logical inconsistencies with it. One is, imagine a child. Did I tell you that joke? I think I told you that. When I was a little boy in a Catholic school, I was warned that I better watch out, because if I'm not careful, I could get run over by a truck. And if I'm run over by a truck while I'm still in a state of sin, I could go to hell for all eternity. And the logical inconsistency here is this: what can an 8-year-old boy do to deserve going to hell for all eternity? I have no doubt that as an eight-year-old boy, I was mischievous and caused problems. It's a fact. But was I bad enough to deserve an eternity of damnation? No one is. So some logical inconsistencies with his doctrine. Another example of a logical inconsistency is this: anything that has a beginning, logically speaking, should have an end. Heaven and hell, from a biblical standpoint, are envisioned as having a beginning and no end. It's a weak position. Now, we can respond by admitting, hey, this is all a matter of belief. Belief means you can't prove it. Belief means you can't disprove it. That is a fact. We discussed also last time that the doctrine of karma is a belief. Can't prove it and can't prove it. But I have a very simple question for you. If you're going to believe something, should you believe something that makes sense or something that doesn't make sense? Would it be better to believe in something that's logically consistent, or would it be better to believe in something that's logically inconsistent? So, it looks like the doctrine of heaven and hell, from a biblical standpoint, are logically inconsistent. You can believe it if you want, but it's an illogical belief. A belief in karma, at least karma, is logically consistent. If you're going to believe in anything, my feeling is, why not believe in something that makes sense, something that's logically consistent? So, what is the Hindu concept, the Vedic concept of heaven and hell? Suppose you're born with Punya and Papa, but suppose, for whatever reason, you have suppose somehow you have 100% Punya karma, 0% Papa karma. This is your Prarabdha karma. And you got somehow, from this infinite pool of Sanchitta, you got only Punyas, you didn't get any Papa. That means a life in which you'd have no suffering. A perfect life. A life of uninterrupted joy and happiness. Does it sound like your life? So, this is our definition of swarga, heaven. Notice, it's not a location. It's not a place. It's not a loka. Although in terms of lokas, we don't know what heaven is. We know what it's not. It's not here. Because it's not possible to live a life without suffering here. So please note then, we're not saying that heaven is a particular place. We're saying that life, that heaven, swarga, is a life of pure enjoyment, a life of zero suffering, a life that's a result of pure punya karmas. Suppose the ratio was reversed, and you were born with only papa karmas, no punya. It would mean a life of total suffering. Every day, suffering, suffering, suffering. Does it sound like your life? Sometimes. In fact, we say hellish day. What a hellish day. And that's an accurate description. A day of pure suffering, from this viewpoint, is like a day in hell. All right. So, notice again, hell, naraka. Naraka is not a particular location. Hell is a life or a condition of pure suffering. Now here's where the doctrines differ. The biblical doctrine and this Hindu doctrine differ very dramatically, and that's this. If you are born with only punya karmas, you get a wonderful heavenly life. But notice that wonderful heavenly life, even though it's a result of only punya karmas, are they infinite punya karmas or finite punya karmas? These are finite. You have only punya karmas, but a finite number or amount of punya karmas, which means every time you enjoy something, you are using up this punya karma. Eventually, this punya karma will be exhausted, and guess what? Your life in the heavenly condition comes to an end, and you get reborn with another set of prarabdha karmas. Similarly, if you're born with only papa karmas, those papa karmas are finite. Every time you suffer, you are reaping the result of those past actions, so you are exhausting these papa karmas, and eventually all of those papa karmas will be exhausted and you'll be reborn with another set of prarabdha karmas. Puja Swami Dayananda, my guru, gave an example. He says, going to heaven is like going to Hawaii. I don't know why he used that example, Hawaii. I have no idea why. I guess a resort place.
And he said, if you save $1,000 and fly to Hawaii, you can have a lot of fun for how long? $1,000 won't last very long. Certainly, with $100 a day will go like quick, easy. So within 10 days, you're going to have spent your $100 and you have to come back. This is the idea of punya karmas. They're finite. Once they're exhausted, then it's over. Then you have to come back. So, of course, once you come back, you can earn another $1,000 and go again, but you have to come back. So Hawaii then was an example for heaven. What would be an example for hell? And I have to tell you a bizarre story. I was with a small group talking about this topic of somebody's home in New Jersey. And I asked this group, and I said, if Hawaii is a good example for heaven, what would be a good example for hell? And one man said, New Jersey. I don't get it. First of all, people in the rest of the country pick on New Jersey as being such a terrible place. Look out the window. Tell me how terrible this place is. Here we are in the most heavily built up part of the country. Right behind us is 3,000 acres of state land, miles of hiking trails, streams, forests. This is a terrible place, don't you think? Anyway, but not only do people in other states pick on New Jersey, New Jerseyans pick on New Jersey. I don't get it. But anyway, this is silly. Anyway, there's a man from New Jersey who said New Jersey is an example of hell. Silly. A good example of hell would be prison. And a high, not one of the country club prisons, but one of the high security prisons where it's really nasty and where you really suffer. So look at this. You do something bad, you're sentenced to prison for 10 years. And the sentence reflects, presumably, the action that you, the crime that you committed. When your 10-year sentence is over, it's over. Your time in prison comes to an end. In fact, you cannot stay in prison longer if you want to. They throw you out because they have somebody else they want to put in your cell. Prison's being overcrowded. So, when the punya karmas are exhausted, if your life is in heaven as a result of pure punya karmas, when it comes to an end, you're reborn with a new set of prarabdha. If you live a life in hell as a result of only papa karmas, when those papa karmas are finally exhausted, you are reborn. This is, to me, brilliant. If you're going to believe in heaven and hell, might as well believe in a realistic, logical depiction of heaven and hell. The way too many religions present heaven and hell are like, sorry to say it, they're like cartoons. And personally, I have a very hard time believing in cartoons. And this is obviously not a cartoonish concept of heaven and hell. It's very profound. It's very logically consistent. It's still a belief, but it is a logically consistent belief. Now, just to finish off our discussion then. What happens to the karmas we commit in this life? This is a third category of karma. One category is the sanchitta karmas, the karmas accumulated over an infinite number of prior lives. Second category of karmas are the prarabdha karmas. Those are the karmas that gave rise to this particular birth. The third category of karmas are karmas that you do in this life. They're karmas that are coming now, and that which is coming now is called agami. Some texts will call it kriyamana, which also means being done. Kriyamana or agami karmas are karmas that you are committing now in this life. So, the actions that you do now in this life, the results which are pending, the karma palas, the punya papa karmas that are pending as a result of actions in this life,
When will those karmas fructify? When will you reap the results of the agami karmas that you're doing in this life? When will you reap those results? The answer is, we don't know. Some of those agami karmas will be reaped in this life itself. That is, good actions you do today may bring a blessing into your life in a few years. Some harmful action that you do today could bring some very undesirable situation into your life in several years. We don't know. But is it necessarily true that all of these karmas will take place in this life? No. So it's also possible that these karmas will affect us in the next life. How can we understand it? Put it like this. Suppose we have, after living 90 or 100 years, we have exhausted all the punya and papa karmas we were born with, but we have these agami karmas that we've done in this life, which did not get fulfilled in this life. At the time of death, these karmas are pending. They're there. Of course, we call law of karma like a law of conservation of matter or conservation of energy. So these karmas are pending at the time of one's death. They don't just disappear. Where would they go? Symbolically, they go back into this sanchitta. By the way, don't take this diagram is symbolic. Don't take it too literally. There's no... It's not like having a bank account someplace. It's very symbolic. It's just meant to help us get some kind of understanding here. So these agami karmas go into this big pool, and then next life, of course, next life, some of the old papa karmas will come in, some of the old punya karmas will come in, some of these agami karmas will come in. And if you ask, and I think the last question here before, because we want to wrap up this topic shortly. If you ask, what is it in a particular life that determines which punya karmas do we have, which papa karmas do you have, what is the relative proportion of these punya and karma, punya and papa karmas that we have in life, how can we figure this out? Come on. We can't. Even, As complicated as what I've written up here, it's a gross oversimplification of how complicated and ultimately unknowable karma truly is. This diagram and this explanation is merely to give us some little bit of insight into how it works in the bigger issue. We could say that we can understand how karma works, we can understand in general. The details we'll never figure out. The details are so complex, so interrelated, there's just no way we're going to figure all of this out. So interrelated, and there's one more thing we should talk about before we leave this doctrine of karma. It's a huge subject, but one more thing to share with you. To illustrate how complicated things are. Not only are your karmas affecting you, but the karmas of people with whom you have a relationship would also affect you. For example, do you think the karma of your spouse, if you're married, do you think your spouse's karma would have some effect on you? Of course. So let's conclude this by going back to that billiard ball example. If you have particular questions on this, we're actually planning the next class. We'll set aside for Q&A. We'll talk about that at the end of today's class. So let's go back to the billiard ball. So once again, here's the pocket that you wanted to go into. So you're going to hit it here. Of course, you don't know that the table is tilted, and the tilting of the table represents your karma. But, of course, what's acting on your life is not only your karma. Really speaking, everyone with whom you have a relationship, wouldn't their karmas have some effect on you indirectly? Sure. Which means your spouse's karma will have some effect on you. How about parents? If your parents are alive, mother, father, father-in-law is a bad joke. Mother-in-law. Notice it's the longest one and it's in opposition. By the way, it's really unfair to pick on mother-in-laws all the time. But we all like to laugh. That's the only excuse I have. All right. Children? Other relatives? Aunts? Uncles? Hey, what about neighbors? Yeah. Neighbors. How about at work? Your boss? That's a big one. Other people? Do you know, everyone that you have a relationship with, their karmas can have an effect upon you, and sometimes you don't even know who you're going to have a relationship with. Here's a funny example. You're at a stoplight, waiting for the light to turn green. Somebody comes slowly up behind you in their car, and bang! You now have a relationship with that person, and clearly their karmas are affecting you. This person just had an argument with his wife, and that's why he is so distracted and not paying attention as he's driving. So really speaking, his karma, someone you don't even know, has now a relationship with you, and it's affecting you. So here's our situation. Here's your free will. Here's your goal. That's the effect of karma. Do you think you can calculate it? Now, you might feel at this point, my gosh, how can we ever make it to our goals? If life is so complicated and unpredictable, how can we accomplish anything at all? And the answer is surprisingly simple. And that is, we keep making corrections in our efforts. That is, we take an action, we see what the results are, and then we make an adjustment. For example, if this is a billiard ball on a table, you hit it and it goes over here. You want it to go over here. Okay. So then you aim in that way, then it goes over here. In fact, if you've ever been on a pool table, you know how it goes. And then you hit it again, and it goes over here. And you hit it again, and it goes over here. And finally, you get it in. Takes several times. Isn't this just how we live our lives? We make an effort, and then we make an adjustment. And we make another adjustment. To give one last example from the field of technology. I'm fascinated by the space research. Think of when they fire a rocket into the sky, and this rocket is going to take a satellite to Mars. Mars is, hundreds of millions of miles away? I don't know what the numbers would be. It's far. Moon is 250,000, right? So Mars must be hundreds of millions of miles. Tell me, do you think NASA has enough technology to aim at that, and by the way, it's a moving target, to aim at that moving target in space 200 million miles away, and with this giant rocket, do you think they can aim it carefully enough? Absolutely not. Then how do you get a satellite to Mars? So you get that big thing up in the sky, and then after a while, you give it a mid-course correction. Then later, after several months, you give another course correction and another course correction. You go on making those course corrections until finally the satellite arrives at its destination to circle Mars. This really symbolizes how we live our lives. Karma is a fact. And the way karma acts upon us is so complicated that there's no way to really calculate it or figure it out. But we know that we can do... There are two things we can do. One is we can go on readjusting our effort. You make an effort, stand back and see what kind of adjustment you should make. And we go on making those adjustments again and again and again, which leads us to an important observation about life. When we make a decision to do something, sometimes we feel like we have to be decisive. This is my decision, and this is what I'm going to do no matter what. Problem is, life is complicated. Situations are often changing. Sometimes we make a decision today, and then the situation changes so much that tomorrow it may look like it's the wrong decision. Then we end up with a dilemma. Should we change our decision, or should we stand by the decisions we have already made? And then somebody will open the Mahabharata and look and use as an example Bhishma Pitamaha, who held on to his convictions. He made these vows as a boy, and he held on to them absolutely through his life. And occasionally somebody will raise Bhishma as an example, as a role model. We should be like Bhishma and hold on to our commitments, our resolutions, no matter what. Anyone who says that hasn't really studied the Mahabharata, because it's clear that the whole problem leading up to the terrible war could have been avoided if Bhishma had not been so rigid. Honestly, the story of the Mahabharata is a very complex story. It shows great people making big mistakes. When Bhishma, and some of you who have studied it properly, you know when Bhishma is dying, you're on the so-called bed of arrows, and Yudhishthira and the others are standing there. At that time, Bhishma admitted that he blew it. He made a mistake. He should have been more proactive. He should have intervened. He should have taken control of the kingdom. He didn't because of his rigidity. Being decisive is a value. Being rigid is not. And how can we be rigid in a life where everything is constantly changing? So, Pooja Swami Dayananda put it so nicely. He said, you have to make decisions. So he said very simply, make a decision today, be ready to change it tomorrow. How's that? It's good. You have to decide, make a decision today, be ready to change it tomorrow. If the situation changes, be ready to. It doesn't mean you should be wishy-washy, but it means we have to respond to the changing conditions of our lives, because look how complicated life is. And the final observation here before we return to our text, there's one more thing we can do when life is so complicated we're not sure what to do. Remember that example of the current? Somebody jumps into the river, wants to go across, but there's a current, and the current is sweeping them away. Most of you were here last week where we symbolically said, there's a current in a river. You jump in a river wanting to swim across, but the current takes you downstream. How to handle the current of karma in our lives, especially when it's so incredibly complex. Imagine this fellow jumping in the river, sensing the current, and starts to panic. And as he's panicking, he's thrashing around. Oh no, current. And he's panicking. He's thrashing about in the water. Is his thrashing about in the water going to help him accommodate for the current and reach his destination? No. In order to, and in our last class, we said
that if this fellow in the river could sense the current properly, he could actually swim in a direction that would compensate for the current, allowing him to arrive exactly at his destination. Now there's a trick. To sense the flow of this current, can you do that while you're thrashing around? No way. In order to sense the flow of that current, this fellow, having jumped in the river, is going to have to remain quiet in that river for a few moments to sense its flow. Thrashing around won't work. Also, can he get the current while he's standing on the shore? Not accurately. The only way he can accurately sense that current is first by jumping in, but then having jumped in, to remain quiet and observant to see how the current is flowing, and then to start swimming in a direction that will compensate for the current. The metaphor for our lives then is in life, if you have a big undertaking, how can you, before jumping in, can you figure out what you're going to do? Just like the fellow standing on the shore, it's good to think it over, but ultimately you're not going to really figure it out until you jump in. So if you're standing on the precipice of a big undertaking, jump! Get started! But once you get started, and then very quickly you'll encounter all the problems, naturally. And here's the trick. When you encounter the problems, instead of getting panicky and thrashing about, and often that happens, we start acting very impulsively and very aggressively when we start seeing problems arise in our lives. Sometimes that's unwise to act impulsively and aggressively because we could sometimes end up doing the wrong thing. We often end up making a bad situation worse. It's true. So, how about this? You jump off the precipice into a totally unknown situation, and then you encounter a bunch of problems, and instead of acting immediately, willfully, impulsively, suppose you wait. You pause. And this is where prayer comes in. Suppose, having jumped off the precipice into this totally unknown situation, encountering all of these unpredicted and unpredictable problems, you're now in a terrible mess, you don't know what to do. This is the best time to pray. Why? That prayer gives you the inner freedom to settle down, to observe the situation more clearly, to figure out what's really happening. When our minds are so turbulent, we can't figure out things properly. We don't see clearly. Our thinking is too distorted. When our minds settle down, then we can see with some clarity. So suppose, having jumped off that precipice into the situation of life, instead of acting impulsively, you respond with prayer, you respond with patience, you respond with consideration. You observe the situation for some time, the situation becomes a little bit more clear, and then you'll be in a much better position to set off in some positive direction to deal with the situation. All right. There's so much more we could discuss, but we'll save it for other times. And we wanted to get into the doctrine of karma thoroughly enough to understand it, because in this context, Sri Krishna is telling Arjuna that, Arjuna, you know that those who are on the battlefield, if they die, they'll be reborn. So we needed to establish his doctrine of karma for this purpose, and we can pick up that chain of thoughts with this verse. In fact, this verse concludes that train of thought. Repeat after me.
Avyaktadini bhutani, avyaktadini bhutani,
Vyaktamadhyani Bharata. Avyakta Nidhananyeva. Tatraka Paridevana.
Bharata, at the end of the line, O greatest of India, O descendant of King Bharat. Really, Bharata, all who have descended from King Bharat are addressed as Bharata. So he's addressing Sri Krishna, addresses Arjuna, and he says, Bhutani, creatures, all creatures, Bhutani are avyaktadini, avyakta adi. Adi means beginning. Avyakta means not vyakta, not manifest, unmanifest. Avyakta, unmanifest. Adi, in the beginning, all bhutani, all creatures, are avyakta. In the beginning, avyakta. Then what? Vyakta madhyani. In the madhya, in the middle, they are vyakta, unmanifest. And avyakta nidhanani eva. Nidhanani, nidhana, in the end. Finally, nidhana. In the end, that they are avyakta, unmanifest. To paraphrase, all creatures are unmanifest in the beginning, manifest in the middle, and unmanifest at the end. What is he talking about? Rebirth. Having died, the sukshma sharira, subtle body, is unmanifest. That is, it's not connected with the physical body. It exists, but it is not having a physical body. We say that the subtle body, sukshma sharira, soul, loosely speaking, is avyakta, unmanifest, adi, in the beginning, which means prior to one's birth. Then madhyani, madhya, in the middle, after you've been born, in the middle of what? Between birth and death. This is a nice memory. Puja Swami Dayananda, I don't know where he picks up some of his jokes. And it's kind of surprising because you most of you know him. He's a very senior and distinguished teacher, acharya and mahatma and this big, long, white dadi and all of this. And then he tells these absolutely silly jokes. And he tells a joke about this gravestone. The message on a gravestone is so Vedantic, he says. He says, you look at the most prominent thing you see on a gravestone is this. Born 1930. In fact, won't even 1932, let's say. You'll see something like this on a gravestone. And he says, how Vedantic. You get born, and then you dash to your death. It's all right there. Well, that's what this verse says, that you are vyakta madhyani. You are manifest in the middle. And then in nidhana, in the end, you are avyakta, once again, unmanifest. When the physical body drops, the subtle body goes back into that unmanifest condition. Tatra, there, in this situation, ka paridevana. What is the concern? What is the reason for worry? Remember the context. Arjuna is grieving over the fact that all of his family members are going to die in a battlefield. The reality is that all of his family members are going to die anyway. If not on the battlefield, then in another situation. Also, Sri Krishna happens to know what eventually is going to happen anyway. Sri Krishna knows that everyone's going to perish on the battlefield. So Sri Krishna is trying to make it easier for Arjuna to cope with this terrible situation, and he says, hey, come on, every single person dies. And in a previous verse, we saw the very famous verse, that he said, everyone that dies gets reborn, everyone who's born dies. So why grieve
for that which is inevitable. So this is the series of verses where Sri Krishna is giving some instruction and comfort to Arjuna to help him cope with the loss, the future loss of his own family members. That concludes the series of verses, and now this is we have just a couple of verses we'll see briefly here at the end of the class. Just fun verses to see. Well, let's begin here.
Ashcharyavat pasyati kashchidenam. Ashcharyavat pasyati kashchidenam. Ashcharyavat varati tathaiva chanyah. Ashcharyavat varati tathaiva chanyah. Ashcharyavat chainaman yashrenoti. Ashcharyavat chainaman yashrenoti. Shrutvapyenam vedana chaiva kashchata. Shrutvapyenam vedana chaiva kashchata.
First, you notice the change of meter. So the other verses being in the shorter Anushtubh Chandas, having 8 syllables and a quarter. This verse being in the longer Trishtubh Chandas, having 11 syllables and a quarter. And it really calls your attention to the verse, and that's the whole purpose. The poet, in this case Vyasa, composes a verse in another meter to call your attention to a very important verse, and an important and amazing verse, because Ashcharyavat literally means amazing, wonderful. It says, Ashcharyavat, it is amazing. What is amazing? That kashchit enam pasyati, kashchit, that someone, enam, this truth, pasyati, should see this truth. The truth of the indestructibility of either Atma or Sukshma Sharira. Remember we said the whole previous verses, sometimes it's talking about Satchidananda Atma, unborn, uncreated, or sometimes talking about the Sukshma Sharira, subtle body, constantly going through rebirth. So these two topics have been discussed. And here Sri Krishna says, Ashcharyavat. Amazing. What is amazing? That kashchit, that anyone, enam pasyati, that anyone can discover this. It is amazing that this can be understood. It's amazing that this can be discovered. Of course, we have it easy. The ancient rishis made these discoveries and passed them down to us. So it's easier for us to make the discoveries if we didn't have the advantage of the scriptures, of teachers, of the what the ancient rishis taught. It would be perhaps really unlikely for any of us as individuals to independently discover this stuff. Extremely unlikely. But with the help of what the ancient rishis taught, what is preserved in our scriptures and taught by modern teachers, we can make that discovery. So we have that opportunity to discover that which Sri Krishna calls Ashcharyavat. Wonderful and amazing that we can understand this, that kashchit, that someone, enam pasyati, that someone can understand this. Ashcharyavat varati tathaiva eva cha anyaha. And he says, Ashcharyavat, it's wonderful that anyaha, another person, tatha eva, in this way, varati, can speak of this. Speak of this means teach. So how amazing it is that we have an opportunity to discover these truths. How amazing it is that these truths can be taught by a teacher. Then in the third line, Ashcharyavat, it's amazing that anyaha, yet another person, shrinoti enam, that another person can hear, shrinoti enam, to have access to these teachings is amazing. So it's amazing that one can, in the first line, amazing that someone can discover this. Second line, amazing that someone can teach this. In the third line, amazing that someone has access to these teachings, can hear it. In the fourth line, shrutva api, this is almost a joke. Shrutva api enam veda na veda eva kashchit. And it's amazing that kashchit, that someone, shrutva api, even having heard these teachings, it's amazing that Ava, that indeed, that this person, Enam Naveda, won't get it, won't understand it. So third line says, how amazing that someone can hear these teachings, can have access to these teachings. And the fourth line, Sri Krishna admits that it's also amazing that we can hear it and hear it over and over and over again, and it may not go in. All right, last verse for today. And cell phones, please. Please remember in future classes that the cell phone should be turned off prior to the class. Thank you. Dehi nityam avadhyoyam. Dehi Dehe sarvasya bharata. Tasmat sarvani bhutani. Natvam shochitam arhasi. Deha is body. Dehi is one that inhabits the body, the indweller of the body. So Dehi, the indweller of the body, referring either to Satchidananda Atma or to Sukshma Sharira. We can look at it from both standpoints. And it says here that the Dehi, the indweller of the body, is Nityam Avadhyaha. Avadhya, cannot be killed. Unkillable, very literally. Nityam, always. The indweller of the body is Nityam, is eternal. It is Avadhya, can't be killed. Ayam, this one. This truth that exists within, the truth that who you are indwelling the body is eternal, Nityam. Avadhya, can never be killed. And it is Dehe, in the body, Sarvasya, of all. In every body, in every living being, there is an indestructible, unborn essence. Remember that important teaching? Nitya, eternal, does not mean for a long time. The only way we can understand Nitya, eternal, is by saying uncreated. So there is, body is created, but within the body there is a truth, an essence which is uncreated. Tasmat, therefore, addressing Arjuna once again as Bharata, therefore Arjuna, Tvam, you, na shochitum arhasi. Na arhasi, you need not, you should not, shochitum, to grieve. O Arjuna, you need not grieve for what? Sarvani Bhutani. For all these creatures, for all these people who are about to die on a battlefield, you need not grieve because we know that their essence will be untouched. Bodies will fall, but the essence, that essential nature, will continue on. As we've really just completed this whole sequence of verses, let us not make a wrong conclusion here that Sri Krishna is saying that we shouldn't experience normal sadness and grief. That's not the point. If someone near and dear dies, grief and sadness is normal. The whole context of these teachings here is this. Arjuna was not just sad and grieving. Arjuna was absolutely overwhelmed by his emotions. Arjuna was incapacitated by his emotions. Sadness is not the problem. Normal grief is not the problem. But being overwhelmed by our emotions, by being incapacitated by our emotional reactions, this is indeed the problem. And so this long series of verses are meant to help Arjuna come out of that being overwhelmed by his emotions, incapacitated by his emotions. Now, in our next class, since we've reached, in the second chapter, there are several major segments. Many chapters have just one topic. The second chapter has several major topics. We're just now finishing one of those major topics. So this would be a good place to pause in our progress through the text. So our next class, we'll set aside for questions and answers. based on the doctrine of karma, or any other questions that you may have. We'll also, remember we chanted the English verses for chapter 1. Maybe we'll include the English verses for chapter 2 when we meet next time. We'll include that in the class. If you have questions, here's one request. If at all possible, please send them by email. It is so helpful to me if I get your questions ahead of time. And one reason it's so nice is it allows me to take your questions and put them in a certain order. And when they're in a certain order, it makes a class much nicer. It's instead of, you know, sometimes you get a question over here and a question over here and a question over there. There's not much consistency to a class if it's like that. It's preferable then, please send me an email, if at all possible, with your questions, and then we'll take those questions up in our next class. Some program announcements. This coming, this coming Friday, we have our guest lecture, and our guest lecturer this time will be our own community member, Raja Bandaru, who is quite a scholar in Ramayana and Mahabharata. And Raja will be talking on the divinity of Rama, what makes him worthy of worship through the centuries. Raja regularly goes out to conferences, not just in his country, but conferences in India and around the world. So it's very nice that Raja will be giving this lecture here. There's some flyers up on the board. You can plan on coming this coming Friday at 7:30. The following Friday is our concert, every third Friday of the month. And this month, Sri Mohan Deshpande will be performing here, and he is a very accomplished musician, singing Hindustani music. So he'll be performing here then a week from Friday at 7:30. Again, flyers up on the board. Then, this summer, as you all know, we have some summer camps for children. Here's a request. We printed up these flyers. It's nice to... when we offer these children's camps, it's nice to reach out to the broader community to invite parents to bring their children for these camps, or delightful camps. In order to help get the word out, could I invite you to come up here and take several flyers and leave them in a temple, leave them in a Indian store, wherever the right people are likely to come, people with Hindu families with children. So there's a big stack up here, several hundred. So please take a stack with you and then help distribute them around the community so that we can let others know that these children camps are going on. Very good. We'll conclude with our arati in just a few moments. Last week after class, and also on Sunday, we went out in the back and did a lot of work getting our picnic area ready. You can go out there and enjoy the picnic area. It's not done. And by the way, thank you to all of you who stayed back on Saturday or who came back on Sunday. Thank you for your work. There's a lot left to do. And here's a suggestion. It's another beautiful day, but it's not nice to go out working all the time. So those of you who would like, after class, join me for a walk. We have these miles I mentioned of beautiful trails. So those of you who would enjoy a walk, after about 15, 20 minutes, I will gather you up and we'll go and enjoy a walk on the trails and back. And then a week from today, next Saturday, those of you who can, stay back after class and we'll go back out and do some more work. And if you want to bring some work clothes or shoes, and you can do that. So today, if you like, please stay after class, join me for a walk. Next week, please plan on helping us outside for some more of these gardening projects. The library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers. Gavinga Vina
Yeah.
Arati. Please help yourself to prasad in the back of the lobby. And those of you who like, join me for a walk in about 15 minutes. I'll come to the lobby. Namaste.